Pop Spotting 196.
Monday, January 16th, 2012.
You're interesting too, in a lost way.
Lost? Oh, well, I guess I am lost.
Welcome to Pod Spotting. I'm Jen.
And I'm Ryan.
It's Movie Monday, and today we're making good on one of our movie resolutions to catch up on some of the movies that we missed last year.
That's right. Many friends told us that Midnight in Paris was worth a watch, as did many of you, Nancy, Cassie, Matt here in Honolulu, the former Lost tour driver, still making wonderful adventures with Expedia. But in any case, now the film is out for rent, if not streaming, and so we gave this newfangled Redbox thing at the supermarket world to see Woody Allen's latest film.
We'll also talk briefly about the re-release of the 1991 Disney animated musical Beauty and the Beast in 3D, which opened this past weekend.
But we will start with Woody Allen. So Midnight in Paris is written and directed by him. It's his 41st film. I think he's a brilliant filmmaker, if not a great person, and his hits are definitely worth his misses. I think you're not so much of a fan, but you were certainly open to checking out this film.
Yeah, people were recommending it to me, who I would never have pegged for Woody Allen fan, so I really thought it was worth a shot. The story follows Hollywood screenwriter Gil Pender, who is played by Owen Wilson, and his fiancee Inez, played by Rachel McAdams. They and her parents and some friends are in Paris, where Gil is trying to finish his first novel, and like many artists, Gil daydreams of moving to France, but Inez thinks that he should get this novel out of his system and go back to just screenwriting.
Right, so this is actually the second time that Owen Wilson and Rachel McAdams played a couple. They were also together on the big screen in 2005 in Wedding Crashers.
In addition to Owen Wilson and Rachel McAdams, this movie has Marion Cotillard, Kathy Bates, Carla Bruni, aka the First Lady of France, Adrienne Brody, and Michael Sheen.
And we meet many, many other colorful characters and actors and actresses in this film. We'll get to them, but it's really Owen Wilson's story, the story of Gil Pender, screenwriter, wannabe novelist. And I have to admit, when it comes to Owen Wilson, I do put him regularly in kind of a dopey guy box. You know, I wasn't sure what we were going to get out of him under Woody Allen's direction, and he kind of has his actors sort of perform in a very stage-like way, not in a bad way, but a different feel for performances, and something that I wasn't sure that Owen Wilson had in him. But it seems that everybody was charmed by Midnight in Paris. Were you charmed by this film?
I was. I have to say that all of the issues I have with this movie are really pretty nitpicky. I think it's missing all of the things about Allen movies that I typically dislike. I think he's really gone in another direction, and this movie is really very sweet and very charming, and it does explore a time and a place that fascinates me.
Well, it is true to say that Midnight in Paris is a film that revels in nostalgia. That is basically the theme, and that's something that I expected, but I was surprised, pleasantly surprised, by the way the film kind of quietly flips that. It turns it, and I think that it both shows what's, you know, compelling and addictive about nostalgia and the past, and the romanticism that comes with that, but also in a smart way, I think, says that, you know, it's great to look back, but you should pay attention to where you are and certainly be ready for the future as well.
I think it celebrates nostalgia in a way, but also serves as a warning, also against pure modernism. Gil's fiance and her friend Paul call themselves realists, and they say that they're modern and intellectuals, and they're the ones to tell Gil, well, nostalgia is just really empty and pointless. But these modern characters, including her friends and her parents, they really come across as materialistic and dimwitted.
Well, yes. I mean, well, I'll say that there's no subtlety here in this film. You know, we know right away who we're supposed to root for and who the bad guys might be. It's not a tough choice between this struggling sweet artist or his practical, somewhat cold wife. And you know, when the movie goes back in time, we do meet, again, a parade of these historical figures. And they, being the nostalgic targets, do come across as almost universally cool and charming and fun. We're supposed to love those characters as well.
I like Wilson's character a lot. Gil is a really sweet guy. He has this sense of wonder and kind of this childlike innocence, but the way that Wilson plays him, he comes across as kind of a surfer dude. He has none of, he doesn't seem to have any of the intellectual curiosity that you would expect Gil to have. He just seems kind of like Dude.
Well, you know, the interesting thing is I can see, I definitely like his character, and it took me a while to warm to Owen Wilson's performance as Gil. But on the other hand, because of the kind of protagonist I remember that I would stereotypically assign to a Woody Allen film, you know, fast talking and neurotic and really smart, but too smart for his own good and gets into trouble with his mouth. I kind of liked this change. Yes, there is sort of the California surfer dude going on with Owen Wilson, but it was a great match, and he does become very lovable. He does become easily the person that you want to follow and you want to see kind of succeed in his dreams or achieve what he wants to get out of this visit to Paris.
And I totally wanted to kick Rachel McAdams' character in the boobs. Just she was she's like an extreme Woody Allen character. She takes the typical Woody Allen female character and dials it up to 11. She's really shrill and snotty and screechy, and I could not sympathize with anything that she was saying. And I know that we're supposed to root against her, because Gil is supposed to come across these really wonderful, charming, witty people and realize what it is that's important in his life. But I would have liked a little bit more subtlety.
Right. I mean, I absolutely agree with you there. Again, you know, Woody Allen is not working with shades of gray, at least in terms of where these characters are positioned on this line, the supposed decision that you have to make about where you want to be, you know, how are you going to value the past or the present or the future and such. So, but I mean, I did think that she was great in terms of that performance. She was so cold. She was still, you know, she was presenting well as a fiance, somebody who is clearly ambitious, has plans for her life, and kind of wants to bring Gil into the real world. You know, she is a little maternalistic, certainly a little condescending, not very sympathetic perhaps, but I thought still believable. You could imagine being at these dinner conversations that they have and kind of keeping your mouth shut and feeling bad for poor Gil and what comes out of his fiance Inez's mouth, her parents and their friends, this other couple that we should talk about. On the other hand, you know, credit to Owen Wilson again, because he plays it cool, whether that's what Owen Wilson does or because that's what he was really giving us here. You don't know if until the very end how he feels about how he's being treated, if he's aware of where he fits in the social structure that they have in their heads. And for the most part, maybe he's just putting up with it, or he's fine with it because he is a good fiancé. He's a good guy, and he loves her. He knows what comes with the territory, and he's not gonna make an issue of it. He's just really cool with it.
You mentioned the other couple. They're played by Michael Sheen and Nina Arianda, and I didn't even recognize Michael Sheen. Michael Sheen was in The Queen. He's been in a bunch of other productions. He was on 30 Rock at one point. I didn't even recognize him. He completely disappeared into this role as this really super intellectual American. I thought he did a really good job.
Yeah, he was Paul, the person that Inez has a previous relationship with, and she kind of finds him just really smart and with it, and he likes to show off. He likes to talk about everything that he knows, whether or not he actually knows what he's talking about. And you know, Paul, and I think Inez in the same way, is not presented sympathetically, somebody that you immediately dislike. But I agree that Michael Sheen did a great job kind of embodying that kind of person, because when I saw him, I was like, who is that guy? I don't know who that guy is. But both as an actor, as a character, and as a person, I'm like, I think we all know a Paul. You know,
yeah,
there's a Paul,
everybody knows a Paul
in every social circle. So his, you know, ability to bring out maybe an emotional reaction out of me was certainly a testament to his performance. I should say, I was just reading Entertainment Weekly, and Michael Sheen was talking about this role as Paul, this character in Midnight in Paris. And there is a reveal later on about his character and what's going on or what's been happening off screen, and he did not know that that was in the script. He had no idea that that was going to be a development, and I think that's another reason why the performance comes off so good, because he's not telegraphing things. He's not, you know, giving hints or dropping hints or really going too far in a certain direction, and that, I think, might be the brilliance of Woody Allen, because he does play with his actors sometimes to get a specific kind of performance out of him. And her parents, Inez's parents, John and Helen, played by Kurt Fuller and Mimi Kennedy, not asked to do too much. They don't do too much. Some good lines, but for the most part, they're playing the parents that are going to be there for their daughter. They probably wouldn't have picked who she picked as her mate, but they're going to go along with it. They're going to try to make the most of it. They're probably going to try to help their daughter, help Gil get back on track, you know, make sure he's with the program. program with the plan.
Fuller has this really great line when he's discussing politics. He refers to Republicans as crypto-fascist zombie airheads.
Right. And, of himself specifically.
Right. And I'm wondering just how political Woody Allen is trying to get. Is he trying to comment on how Europeans see Americans, or does he really see them like that? I mean, I know he's lived in Europe for a lot of years, and I think he's really trying to approach politics and international relations in a pretty clever and interesting way. He's not really commenting either way.
Well, I don't think that that's even a major part of this film, but I agree that, you know, maybe since he's moved over there, he's kind of feeling that he feels the same way about Americans. But I'll tell you this, I mean, even when he was making quintessential American films, he was making commentaries about how ridiculous America can be. So, but that's an interesting observation. But fortunately for Gil Pender, for Owen Wilson's character, there are other women that can come through his life and show him that there might be another way than the path that he's on. And that's where Adriana comes in. She's played by Marion Cotillard. You've got Carla Bruni, as you mentioned, more of a side character, as well as, I wanted to mention, Lea Seydoux. She's also a very side character, but she was immediately familiar because she was the assassin in Mission Impossible. So yeah. It was good to see her again.
She's also Melanie Laurent's sister in Inglourious Basterds.
That's right. And so for these female characters, especially compared to the others that we're presented with, it's these female characters, Adriana in particular, that are given all the depth, all of the question marks, all of the mystery, you know, where are they, what are their motivations, what's going on. And so, again, I think Woody Allen is being very clear that there are some people that we should just dismiss or dislike, and some characters that he wants us to be as enchanted by, confused by, and want to be curious about as some of these other characters.
I thought Marion Cotillard was the best part of the movie. She was just so beautiful, and she was just hypnotic. Whenever she spoke, whenever she was on screen, I was just so drawn to her, as I know Gil was, but for so many reasons. She seemed to have a really deep understanding of people, and when she was talking about the 1890s and how she wanted to go back, I really felt it. I really believed her, and she did such a lovely job.
Well, she's an interesting pairing. She turns out to be an interesting foil for Owen Wilson. I'll agree that, yes, she is the standout in this film. She's the character you love, the one you want to spend the most time with, and certainly you can see why Gil would fall for her. But, you know, up against Owen Wilson, I think Marion Cotillard is so amazing that it's like suddenly finding the deep end of the pool after you've really kind of been enjoying yourself, maybe just waiting around.
Yeah, I agree.
It just kind of adds that extra dimension. But Gil is not just, you know, drawn to Adriana and the city of Paris, but to a specific time, a specific place, to its history. He's an artist. He wants to be a novelist. So he really idealizes the people in the past. So we actually meet in this film historical figures like F. Scott Fitzgerald and
Gertrude Stein, right, Salvador, right, Dali, Cole
T.S.
Porter,
Eliot, Picasso, Matisse, Gauguin. I mean, it just runs the gamut, and it is fantastic because by going to a specific time, that's where all of these people were contemporaries, at least a number of them were.
And I was surprised that these historical and literary figures, except for Adrian Brody as Salvador Dali and Kathy Bates as Gertrude Stein, they weren't really played by well-known people, which gave it, I think, an interesting twist, because when you're looking at a historical figure played by a really well-known actor, you're thinking, well, that's not the historical figure, right, that's the actor. And I think having fairly unknown faces playing these parts really helps to put a face on historical figures that you've never seen on TV or in movies.
Well, I agree. It was a smart choice, because I loved seeing, you know, Kathy Bates, but you're watching her and you're watching Kathy Bates. She's doing Kathy Bates. So although she is playing Gertrude Stein, you're not seeing Gertrude Stein, whereas when you're seeing a lot of these other famous figures, you have to just kind of go with what you're presented. And you know, I'm not going to say that they're deep explorations of these characters. It's not really about who they were or what their lives were about, but what they represented, both to the time that they lived and, of course, to Gil, you know, the centerpiece of the story. It's really what they represent, what they symbolize, and not who they were. But I did like that we got to meet them. And I have to admit, I wish I had paid more attention in history class, because I knew a lot of these names, but not the stories and how they connected. I think people that did pay attention in history class might enjoy this aspect of Midnight in Paris a lot more than perhaps I did.
And another thing that I really liked is that none of these historical figures that meet Gil comment on the fact that he is clearly from another time. and there's no wondering on the parts of the characters, okay, how did I get here? It's just a very natural thing. It's not explored. It's just taken for granted. And I like that. I didn't want the story to be bogged down in details.
Well, and the thing is, I'm trying not to talk too much about that aspect of it, because that is what I think a lot of people are delighted by. But I agree. There's no obsession over how any of this happens. I mean, they don't go sci-fi at all. It's just taken for granted. These interactions just happen. These are people that we want to see deal with each other and not really question their reality. And I definitely give Woody Allen credit for that. There is a point where it gets a little recursive. I mean, there's an extra level of nostalgia within nostalgia that when we hit it, I'm like, uh-oh, this might suddenly turn into a different kind of movie.
It gets a little Inception.
Yeah, but it doesn't. It doesn't. And so part of me kind of hopes that newcomers to the film come in as cold as we did and, you know, just kind of let that aspect, you know, these characters in this world kind of wash over them. It's a great film. It's a great looking film.
One of the things beautiful
that I think I wasn't expecting out of Woody Allen, or at least in this, you know, he's done some interesting movies in the last 5 years, but that didn't really strike me as movie making achievements as much as, I guess, maybe decent character studies and stuff. But this movie looks like a great movie. The cinematography is fantastic.
He's really going back to the style of older films. The cinematography is beautiful. Just a lot of warm colors and dim lights and very, very sparse camera movements. It did have the look of a much older film. So I felt, as much as he loves Paris and was trying to get us to love Paris too, I really felt like this was a celebration of film as well.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, as the credits rolled, you're like, okay, forget going around Asia. I definitely want to visit Paris next. So it was a success in that respect. And I agree, you know, I think that, the opening sequence of this film is great because it's just these really stable shots of the streets of Paris. It's, you know, maybe even postcardy shots, but it goes on long enough that it makes you settle down. First you're like, okay, it's the opening sequence. Then you're like, can we get on with it? You know, you're waiting for something to happen, and then it goes just a little bit longer so that you sit down and go, okay, I gotcha. We need to just kind of let all this wash over us. We're going to get to know Paris. We're going to get to know these people, these characters, and that exploration, you know, the path and the journey that they take. And again, as great as that journey is, I don't want to diminish, I think, the significance of where the film ends up and its little message at the end, that as wonderful as this journey through the past and understanding and appreciation of it is, there's something to be said about living in the present, for sure.
I thought the ending was really abrupt, and not necessarily in a bad way. It just, he seems to come to this epiphany about himself and about his life very quickly, and he very quickly sets about changing his life, and I think that's a great way to end the film.
Yeah, it leaves you thinking, and it definitely leaves you pondering kind of, I would say, a lot of these same questions about your own life, and that's probably the best thing that you can say about a Woody Allen film, and certainly about Midnight in Paris. It was, of course, widely critically acclaimed. We were just reading a list from Quentin Tarantino. Mm-hmm. He picked it as one of his top films of the year.
It was his number one film.
It was his number one film, and a lot of people say that it's Woody Allen's best in a long time. I would have to say we would agree.
Absolutely.
We'd encourage you to check out Midnight in Paris. I just could not wait. We couldn't wait until it was streaming. It will eventually, but right now you can pick it up on DVD and Blu-ray. We went to Redbox for the first time. That was interesting. It is available for rent via streaming on Amazon and iTunes for $4. And certainly worth a look.
Mm-hmm.
Now, before we close, we did see a new release in the theaters, except that it's not at all a new release, and it is the 3D reissue of Beauty and the Beast. Now, turning favorite films from decades ago into 3D movies is definitely a thing now. They're making Titanic into a 3D movie. The Star Wars films are going to come back out in 3D, and Disney did the same. They did very well with the 3D re-release of The Lion King earlier last year, so this, Beauty and the Beast, is their next revival.
Beauty and the Beast came out in 1991. It was the first ever animated film to be nominated for an Academy Award for Best Picture, and it got a total total of 6 nominations.
And of course, this wasn't that long ago, but we were still both teenagers when it came out. So, I mean, was it at least great to see this movie, this classic Disney musical again?
It was wonderful to see it again. Absolutely. It got really, really, really super dusty in the theater. They gotta fix that because I loved every minute, but is it worth $15 to see it in 3D? No. I mean, it looks good, but ultimately it doesn't add anything to the story. Beauty and the Beast was one of the last hand-drawn Disney movies, and that is what I love about it. I love the way it looks, and that's why I keep watching it, because it's timeless to me.
I agree. And, you know, I mean, this film did have some of the first tries by Disney to use CGI. There was the plates sort of dancing around, and then there's that final scene in the ballroom with the chandelier. That was Disney kind of testing the waters using computer graphics. I would agree that, you know, adding 3D to older movies makes sense if the movie does use a lot of computer graphics, because the computers know what the depth is and how you're supposed to add that dimension when you have an opportunity to do it. But doing that effect, using this 3D process, whatever it is that they did for Beauty and the Beast, is kind of a stretch when you're working with old school animation cells. I mean, frankly, although it was a neat effect, it was also distracting. It kind of felt like a diorama, you know, layers of paper in front of each other, but still mm-hmm. flat as layers. And they were really forcing the perspective. I mean, this is what kind of bugs me about 3D movies, because when they want you to focus at something in the distance, they blur out what's in the foreground, even though you're like, I want to see that flower or that, you know, ladybug in the foreground. But they're making it all smudgy because they want you to look somewhere else. I mean, just looking for, you know, evidence of this work, looking at the edges of these layers kind of becomes distracting for me.
I'd forgotten how great the music is in this movie. You know, Belle, Beauty and the Beast, Be Our Guest. Be Our Guest is one of the best Disney songs ever, and just to go and hear those songs again made it worthwhile.
Yeah, well, I mean, this was Alan Menken and Howard Ashman. They had written the music previously for The Little Mermaid, and it was for the music that this film won those Oscars. You know, Best Original Score, Best Original Song for Beauty and the Beast, and I think, you know, rightfully so, it came up during our recent conversations about favorite musicals among our listeners. Mm-hmm. Now, we should mention that this re-release does come with some new material, a 3D animated short called Tangled Ever After, you know, kind of the next chapter to the film Tangled. I wouldn't ever say that these shorts are really worth seeing the movie they're attached to, but did you like it? I mean, was it a lot of fun?
It was okay. It was pretty conventional. After the recent Pixar shorts, it really felt like kind of a letdown.
I enjoyed it. I thought it was a lot of fun. I mean, it was certainly a full exploitation of 3D. They did everything to just kind of have you drag through the streets and up in the air and flying around. I mean, that physics is kind of fun, and mm-hmm. all of the little things that you liked about Tangled, like even those lanterns make an appearance, and seeing those is kind of cool. But yeah, it's a lot of fun. I think that, you know, it's worth seeing Beauty and the Beast again on the big screen, but I really think that I would have seen it and enjoyed it without any 3D attached to it.
Yeah, I certainly would have.
Unfortunately, this stuff isn't over. There's more to come. In September of this year, they're going to do Finding Nemo in 3D. I think that, again, might work because it was, you know, heavily computer generated, and there's, you know, the underwater scenes might look good, but next year you've got Monsters, Inc. You've got a prequel to Monsters, Inc., in fact, and The Little Mermaid is going to turn up in 3D. So there you have it, Midnight in Paris and Beauty and the Beast in 3D. That's our Movie Monday, and we always want your suggestions on what we should be seeing. We haven't done a double feature in a while, so that might mm-hmm. come up after our break, and you can give us your ideas by emailing us at feedback@popspotting.net. You can leave a comment on our blog at popspotting.net, or best of all, you can leave a voicemail that we can share on the show at 815-310-0808.
You can also post on our Facebook page at facebook.com/popspotting, and you can catch us on the newfangled Twitter thing at twitter.com/popspotting.
Come back tomorrow for TV Tuesday, where we're going to explore a series that we completely missed, but that we now completely love, called Terriers.
Thanks to Dan Pashman of The Sporkful for our theme song, and thank you for listening.
For Popspotting, I'm Ryan.
I'm Jen. Salamat tinggal.
What she said.